Take your career to the next level. The University of South Florida, St. Petersburg is offering a master's degree in digital journalism and design. Do the entire program from home and complete it in as little as 1 year. The cost is reasonable. The experience is invaluable. For more information, call 727-873-4544.
Discover your career in oceanography at the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science, where groundbreaking research meets hands-on learning. Located in St. Petersburg, Florida, we offer cutting-edge research opportunities with world-renowned faculty. Students at the USF College of Marine Science gain experience across the disciplines of oceanography to steer them on a course for greatness. Visit us at usf.edu/marine-science to begin your ocean journey.
From the College of Marine Science at the University of South Florida, this is the Rising Tides podcast. Join us as we explore how researchers are using cutting-edge technology to unravel secrets of the ocean. Here is your host from the university's Department of Journalism and Digital Communication, Professor Elliot Weiser.
Hello, everyone. Imagine you are walking along the beach and gaze out over the ocean. You enjoy the amazing colors of the water, but there's more to that color than beauty. In today's episode of the Rising Tides podcast, we'll unlock the secrets of ocean colors. To help us do this, let's welcome our guest. Professor Frank Mueller Karger is the director of the College of Marine Science Institute for Marine Remote Sensing at the University of South Florida. Professor Mueller Karger, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you.
So, as I mentioned, most people only think about ocean color in terms of aesthetics, but the color can tell us more than that, can it?
Yeah, but the color of the ocean can be very beautiful. It can be scary. It can be ominous. It can be actually not very appealing at some points. So we can all start in awe at the beauty of the deep blue of the ocean far away from the coast, or the turquoise, greens, and cream color of pristine tropical beaches. But also, this color carries tremendous amount of information. And color in general in our lives has a lot of information. Up close, the color can look blue or be milky green, but it can also be yellow, green, red, brown. And that tells us a lot about what's going on in the water, or even if the water is shallow. And this has been used a lot by mariners over, you know, centuries, where the color of the water can tell you a little bit about depth. Or if you're close to the coast, if you see a river, a plume, things like that. So we can learn a lot about what's happening in the water from the color. The water color can tell us a little bit about water quality, whether it's good or bad to swim in it, or so, if it is appealing or not. We can see fronts in the water. If there is different water masses, one next to the other, they can have different colors. And often fish accumulate around these boundaries, so fishermen recognize these fronts. So color is used around the world that way by people for forever, really, even to make quantitative measurements of phytoplankton.
We'll get into more detail on what color means in a minute, but I do want to ask you, is this a relatively new thing? Studying ocean color has been going on for a while.
It really has been going on for a while. I think even the Greeks had writings about ocean color.
Really?
Homer wrote about the color of the ocean and different hues. And this was 800 years before the Common Era. But more actively, I think in the 1800s, you had people that started to get more interested in actually measuring the color or the turbidity of the water. In fact, because they wanted to learn about depth or whatever was in the water. So there was a guy in the 1800s called Secchi, an Italian guy, and he designed this little round plate, if you imagine a white disc, that you could lower with a rope. And when it disappears from sight, then he compared different depths around different parts of the Mediterranean. Then a Swiss physician, a guy called Forel, wanted to know how you can compare different lakes in Switzerland. And so he designed these little tubes full of dyes, and he could compare the colors of the different lakes at different times of the year. And so he went around doing that. And that's actually used today still in oceanography.
Interesting.
People that use numerical models of the ocean, they have computational fluid dynamics. They use those scales to actually see how much sunlight is captured by ocean water, and that can tell you something about how much the water would be heating up, absorbing light.
So that leads to my next question. How do you measure ocean colors?
Ocean color is, let me start with a little bit of history here because I think it's relevant. Isaac Newton was interested in how you understand rainbows. And so he looked at prisms, for example. And so he looked at how light going through a piece of glass could decompose into different colors. And he called that the spectrum, like the ghost that is inside white light. And he understood that water does sort of a similar thing. So we talk about the colors of water as the spectrum of light. And the spectrum of light has, you know, blue, green, yellow, red, orange. And yeah, so all of these different colors are the balance of what you see when white light from the sun goes into the water. It interacts with water and whatever is in the water. And it, then whatever comes out and is reflected by the water is what we try to interpret, no? So when you think about light being decomposed over a rainbow, if you were to position little sensors at each one of these colors, you can measure not only the wavelength, the color at which you're trying to measure, you position it in the right color, but also the intensity. So color is really those two things, the wavelength of the color, but also how many photons are in that color. So if you have a rainbow, you have to create the rainbow. And so when we measure color, for example, from a satellite or from a sensor right on Earth, we have either a prism, or we have a filter, or we have something that we call diffraction gratings, which are like if you look at a CD and you look at light bouncing off of it, you see rainbows. Where if you position sensors on that rainbow, then you can measure the amount of photons at that color, and that's how we basically measure.
Interesting. So earlier in this podcast, you mentioned what ocean colors can tell us. Let's get into some specifics. What can the ocean colors tell us about what's going on below the surface?
Ocean color is, as we were just talking about before, is the result of whatever photons come out of the water after they've interacted with the water or whatever is in the water. So water, even though if you put it in a glass of water, pure water is transparent, but if you put it in a big pool or in the ocean, that water will look blue. So if you have pure water, completely clean water, it will look blue, deep blue, the deeper the water is. And the reason for that is that water absorbs different colors in different ways. Anybody that dives knows that yellow, red disappears very quickly below the surface. But blue and green light continue to go down, especially blue in clear water. Blue light continues to go down farther than other colors. And the same thing is that you see the blue is because it's being scattered back to you. So those blue photons hit your eye, and they can actually go back through the surface out of the water. So in clear blue water, what you see is the blue photons coming back out of the surface of the ocean, just because that's what was not absorbed. It still absorbs blue light, but there's enough to bounce back. So if you start putting things in the water, like phytoplankton, these little organisms, single-celled organisms that have chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is green. Or if you have detritus, dirt, clay, sand, anything that you put in the water is going to modify how much light is absorbed and how much is scattered. And the balance of that is what you see. So if the water is greener, that means that it's less blue and less red. If you have more red, it means that all the blue was absorbed, all the green was. So the balance of that is what we try to interpret. And so if the water is very green, we know that there's a lot of algae in there typically. If the water is very brown, we think that there's a lot of other kinds of dirt or even dissolved organic matter like tannins, like when we have rivers like the Suwannee River, where it's very dark and brown. Those are natural substances, but they're very brown. That means they absorb all the other colors shorter than that, it's like blue and especially blue and green. So we try to interpret what is in the water, knowing the color of the water and then knowing the colors of all these other things. And we try to put them in proportions to understand the color.
So can the color of the water detect potential environmental threats?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for example, one of the biggest threats that we have right now is climate change. And so when we use measurements of ocean color from satellites, we can see the whole world very quickly. In 2 or 3 days, we get a complete picture of the world ocean. And we do that day after day, you know, month after month. Now we have about 30 years of that kind of data. So we can see how the world is changing, and we can see that some parts of the ocean are getting greener, some other parts are getting bluer. And the balance of that tells us, for example, where you can have fisheries or if fisheries are being healthy or not. And so we use that as a way to measure the health of the planet. And if things change in a big way, and they're starting to change, that is a threat to us, to our industry, to our fisheries, to our own health. More locally, water color and the concentration of chlorophyll has been used by EPA, but many people around the world to measure how good the water is. Is the quality of the water any good? We can also measure things like red tides or what we call harmful algae blooms. And so there's different kinds of harmful algae blooms. There are some that are by bacteria, like cyanobacteria or these blue-green algae. But there's also other types of red tide, like off of here, off of Florida. And you can see those very, very clearly from space because the patches are very big, big enough to see from space. So those types of threats are, so water quality, how good the coastal water quality is, red tides, and even changes at larger scales are things that we can see.
So I think I know the answer to this, but humans can impact the color of oceans, can't it?
Totally. Humans... We're making more uses of the ocean every day, from mining or fishing or recreation, you name it. We're more and more getting into the water, which is great. But anything that we do has an impact, and so those impacts can be good or it can be bad. And so, if we manage the way that we behave or the activities that we do, then we can actually have a very good positive impact, and we can have a metric of that by looking at ocean color. If we dump chemicals, nutrients, if we are not careful about how we dig the bottom of the ocean, that causes turbidity or causes fertilization for other types of blooms. And so that will change the color of the water, and we can measure that.
You mentioned Florida a few minutes ago. Let's talk about Florida specifically. What changes have we seen in ocean color off the coast, either coast of Florida?
The color of the water is changing all the time. No, so you can see an increase of red tides over time, and we have documented that. You can see that in the satellite data. We also see that there is a seasonal change. So we try to separate events from seasonal changes. That's part of the research that we have to do to see what is an anomaly. You know, so if it's normal and nothing changes or is the same every year, then who cares? No, but what we want to know is something happening that is abnormal. And we can see that, for example, after a hurricane, there's big river plumes, big events that carry detritus and coastal waters offshore. Some of that goes, for example, from the western coast of Florida down south and over the Florida Keys. And so we try to monitor that because some of these events are harmful to the corals. And so there's a big program trying to understand how is the flow from the Everglades changing as we repipe the Everglades, and is that affecting corals? And so we can use ocean color for that. So the color of the ocean is changing all the time, whether offshore waters that are relatively blue come closer to shore, or if we have events that cause upwelling, so nutrients that are coming from the deep ocean onto our coast, or if we see runoff onto the shelf that affect shellfish or sponges or corals.
Is there a part of the world that has seen a dramatic change in ocean color? And if so, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think that there are different parts of the world that are changing in different ways. So, for example, one of the areas that is really very interesting to see are the changes that are happening in the Indian Ocean. A lot of the Indian Ocean, a big area, is now routinely, seasonally, being covered by a little algae called Noctiluca. And so that you can see that from space. There are, you know, hundreds of miles of patches of these algae that are at the surface. So that's one that wasn't there before. And in the 30 years that we have satellite data, we can see how that has evolved. And so we think that that's because there are changes in the wind, in the monsoon patterns, and so on. So that's one. Another one that people are looking at is in the middle of the ocean. The middle of the ocean, like the middle of the Atlantic or the Pacific, that's what we call the big ocean gyres. Typically, those are, we call them ocean deserts, although they're not really deserts. There's life there, but the amount of phytoplankton is relatively low. And what we're seeing is that they're becoming bluer. So that means that there, even though there is few phytoplankton there historically, they're becoming more blue and there's less phytoplankton. So that eventually has implications on the food chain. You know, big fish live there like tuna and other creatures. And so the question is, does that bluing of the ocean have an impact on big food chains?
Could that be a bad thing?
Well, if the tuna don't have much to eat out there, then that's an issue. If the lack of production or the decrease in phytoplankton concentrations expands, that means that the ocean is less productive, and so ultimately that will affect fisheries more broadly. But it also affects things like gas exchange between the ocean and the atmosphere, and phytoplankton is very active in the production of oxygen, and also takes up carbon dioxide. So it's one of these organisms that, just because of the size of the ocean and the amount of phytoplankton out there, it has a huge impact on an annual basis on how much of the oxygen comes out of the ocean and how much carbon dioxide goes into the ocean.
And do you know what is causing that decrease yet?
The understanding at this point is that the ocean is warming up. We know that because we can measure that very easily. There's no question about it. And it's been warming up for the past 20, 30 years. We can easily demonstrate that. So when the water at the surface of the ocean becomes warmer, it's less dense. And so that water that is less dense now sits more stably on top of colder water below. And so it doesn't mix as deep as it would have 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. So the idea that we have in the way that the ecology of the ocean works is that phytoplankton, these blooms that happen seasonally that are normal and good, they happen in the middle of the ocean because the ocean mixes. In the winter, because of the wind and cold air, make the surface of the ocean mix. That brings nutrients like nitrate, ammonia, silica, phosphate from deeper waters up into the surface. And as soon as you have light, like in the spring, then you have blooms. Now, if the ocean is harder to mix, then you have less of that nutrient supply and you have less phytoplankton in the spring.
Interesting. Artificial intelligence. Let's talk about that because it's part of just about everyone's life now. Is that changing the way you're studying ocean color?
It's changing everything. So yes, artificial intelligence is something that is not really new. 40 years ago, we used to call it pattern recognition, but it's the same thing. And now we call it machine language or artificial intelligence. And what has changed is the speed of computers and the size of the databases that we can manage. And so the ability for us to use computers to go through enormous amounts of data is allowing us to make predictions and forecasts based on a model that is built just by having so much data. And so that's what's different.
Mm-hmm. As our producer was researching you and this topic, came across the Marine Life 2030 program. What is that?
Marine Life 2030 is an effort to network people around the world under an umbrella of the United Nations. The United Nations came up with this concept of an ocean decade, and that started in 2021, and it sort of goes 2021 to 2030, to pay attention about what's going on with the ocean, especially for sustainable development. So how can we develop the ocean in a way that is sustainable and conserve or protect resources as we develop in an intelligent way? So it's to promote development, but in a way that we can continue to develop way into the future. And so the Marine Life 2030 is a program under this umbrella of the ocean decade to try to understand life in the sea. One of the issues that we have with marine biologists is that we don't follow standards very well. There are many standards in biology, but there's almost too many. It's not like in engineering or in the medical fields or in chemical fields or in pharmaceutical. Even meteorologists have standards that allow you to compare the weather from one day to the next, and that goes into a model, and then you can forecast weather. In biology, it's very hard to do that because it's very difficult for us to compare data between one group making measurements and another group making measurements. So Marine Life 2030 is an effort to help people converge on standards for biodiversity measurements and to share the data in a way that we can understand whether what I'm seeing here today is due to larger scale changes or due to something that we're doing locally. And today we cannot do that very easily.
One final question. What role is the College of Marine Science at USF playing in this program?
We lead Marine Life 2030, so we proposed it to the United Nations, and they endorsed it, and so that is part of the kinds of things that we do at the College of Marine Science. In terms of ocean color, there's a lot of things that we do that have national and international relevance. That's just one. We also lead something called the Marine Biodiversity Observation Network, which is really where Marine Life 2030 was born from. It's that effort to network people around the idea of standards and interoperability. How do you respect the collection of data by different people, and how do you publish it? But we also at the college have a program, for example, Dr. Chuan Min Hu, who measures sargassum seaweed in the ocean from space.
One of our topics on the podcast.
It's an amazing effort where he can use satellite data to map sargassum seaweed across the entire Atlantic and show that it's moving into the Caribbean and then eventually reach our coast. So over the years, we have contributed a lot to this field. For example, one of the program manager at NASA headquarters for the Ocean Color Program is a graduate from our college at USF. And she's amazing. So this is the kind of thing that we can do.
Wonderful. It's great to hear this kind of research coming out of USF, and the college continues to lead. And Professor Frank Mueller-Karger, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
On the next episode of the Rising Tides podcast, we'll be tackling one of the most important environmental issues facing our planet, rising sea levels. Please share this podcast with your family and friends and give us an excellent rating and review on Apple or Spotify. Until next time, I'm Professor Elliot Weiser.
Thank you for listening to the Rising Tides podcast, produced by the Department of Journalism and Digital Communication in cooperation with the College of Marine Science at the University of South Florida. Executive producers are Elliot Weiser and Dylan Furness. Producers are Jensen Horvath and Rhiannon McIsaac. Director is Christopher Campbell. And a special thank you to Dr. Mark Walters and to all of our guests from the College of Marine Science who shared their research with us.